I'm Alan Little, and this is the final part of Turkey, the New Ottomans, a series for the BBC World Service looking at how Turkey is redefining its place in the world.
Avrupa Birliği Parlamentosu bizimle ilgili karar almış. Haddini bil ya. Haddini bil.
Recep Tayyip Erdogan, charismatic, pugilistic, populist Prime Minister of Turkey, is in full retaliation. After the anti-government demonstrations that swept Turkey in the spring, he draws a crowd of his own. It is hundreds of thousands strong. He is reminding the world that he has been elected with strong majorities three consecutive times, that he still commands enormous support. And to the cheers of the crowd, he suggests that the European Parliament and the EU should put their own houses in order before criticizing the way he dealt with this summer's protests in Turkey. In other interviews, he condemned the European Union as anti-democratic. Odd, then, that Erdogan's party, the AKP or AKP, still hopes to lead Turkey to full EU membership. When they came to power 11 years ago, Turkey's Islamists were strongly in favour, seeking a mainstream European destiny for Turkey. Sinan Ulgan, chairman of Istanbul's Centre for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies.
It certainly established an alliance with the segments of society in Turkey that were pro-European, essentially to benefit from the EU dynamic to further Turkey's democracy. There were a number of fundamental constitutional and legal reforms that were adopted and implemented.
It comes as a surprise to many people here that an Islamist party should be so passionately committed to a European identity.
One reason for that, because it was a party that traces its roots to political Islam. So when it came to power, there were fears that it would have an Islamist agenda. And one way to overcome those fears was to go after the EU objective, which has helped AKP in its initial years.
And the initial years were years of rapid progress, of rapid reform in Turkey to make the country's economy, its government, its legal system compliant with EU standards. But in 2005, Turkey's journey to Europe hit an obstacle. Opposition to Turkish membership in Germany and France stalled the accession process. The EU added new conditions and terms that, Turkey argued, had not been applied to other candidate countries. Croatia became the 28th member state earlier this year.
Turkey, along with Croatia, actually on the same day, started its membership negotiations with the EU. But the conditionality that was imposed on Turkey for these negotiations was perceived as being discriminatory by both the Turkish policymakers but also Turkish public opinion.
When the process stalled, a powerful impetus to further reform in Turkey was lifted. The AKP began to suspect that Europe would always find a pretext on which to deny Turkey full membership. Public opinion in Turkey shifted dramatically. Support for EU membership fell from over 70% to less than 40%. The AKP government began to seek new ties with its Arab neighbours, from whom the Turkish Republic had isolated itself for nearly a century. Turkey began pulling the lands of the old Ottoman Empire around itself again, creating a new sphere of interest in the world, with Turkey at its heart. In this programme, I want to examine the viability of Turkey's European aspiration, of the European part of its dual Euro-Asian identity. After the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the founders of the Turkish Republic sought to turn their backs on hundreds of years of Ottoman history. They associated the Ottomans with corruption, stagnation, and decay. But there was one part of the imperial legacy they did emphasize, the European part. For the Ottoman Empire had its roots in the Balkans. The 20th century Turkish Republic wanted to return to what it saw as its natural European home, a home Turkey had shared throughout the Ottoman era for 600 years.
Even in this city, and even after all this time, no one would have believed a single explosion could take so much life.
When I was reporting the bloody collapse of Yugoslavia in the early 1990s, it seemed like a conflict from another age. And in a sense, it was exactly that.
The Serb gun positions above the city.
The wars in Croatia, in Bosnia, in Kosovo had their roots in the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire at the end of the First World War. When I look back now, after 20 years, I can draw a direct line between that conflict and the wars of national liberation fought against the Ottomans in the Balkans in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The Bosnian War seems to me now the last desperate act, delayed by 80 years in the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, but played out in the television age. I've come up the hill to one of the high places on the southern edge of the city, where there was a Serb gun position during the siege of the early 90s. Up here you see how vulnerable, how exposed Sarajevo was then. The whole city is laid out like a map beneath your feet, shimmering today in the summer haze. Did the Serb gunmen up here, as they selected their targets and trained their fire, remember that the streets below them were full of their former neighbours, terrified and defenceless down there? I remember coming up here a few months into the war and the shock of hearing for the first time the Serb soldiers referring to their Muslim enemy not as Muslimani or even anymore as Mujahideen, but as something much more visceral, much more demonic in the Serb nationalist imagination. They referred to them as Turci. The people of Sarajevo had become, for them, Turks.
It was actually beaten very severely. How can you say that he was just beaten to death?
Emir Filipovic was 8 years old when the war started. His father died after being interned by Serb forces in a prison camp.
He was elected as a representative of the concentration camp inmates. And when the Red Cross came, he was asked to give a statement. Him being the man he was, he said what was going on to the Red Cross, and I presume that that cost him his life.
Emir's father was one of more than 100,000 who died between 1992 and 1995. He was a history teacher, and Emir himself is now a lecturer in early Ottoman history at the University of Sarajevo. The Ottomans built the oldest part of their empire in Europe.
They did manage to conquer the whole of the Balkan Peninsula before conquering Constantinople. One of the Ottoman methods of conquest was, in order to consolidate the depopulated areas which they conquered, they managed to import Turkish population from Anatolia. As the Ottoman conquest moved more to the west, this became less of a practice because it was much more difficult to bring larger numbers of population over the course of a broader space.
In the furthest reaches of their European empire, instead of importing Turkish-speaking people from Anatolia, the Ottomans recruited a governing class from among the local Slavic populations who converted to Islam. That, especially in Bosnia, would have consequences that would reach into the 21st century.
One of the reasons why the Bosnians are Muslims but not Turkophones is because they are converts. They have been integrated through not forceful, but, you know, willing conversion into Islam already in the 14th, 15th century.
Edem Eldem is a historian at Bogazici University in Istanbul. The Ottoman Empire evolved into a vast, multi-ethnic, multi-confessional imperium with a genuinely multi-ethnic ruling class, both in the outlying lands of the empire and in Istanbul itself, but with Islam emphatically as the established religion.
There is one standard identity which is accepted as being the right one, which is Muslim. And then you have the others, Judaism and Christianity. And those have a status of inferiority, which is defined in terms of A, adult males paying a poll tax, from which the Muslims are exempted, and a combination of other symbolic ways of accepting a form of submission to Muslim rule. Typical example, there's no way a non-Muslim man can marry a Muslim woman, whereas the contrary is possible. So it's an inequality which, I mean, compared to what is going on in Europe at more or less the same time, you may even call it tolerant, in the sense that there is total freedom of practicing your religion, but, as I said, with a number of obligations that are at least symbolically demeaning.
And is it the case that co-option by the Ottoman Empire was attractive to local governing elites because it helped keep them in power? By paying tribute, they also benefited.
Sure, the Ottoman system of integration works because there's mutual benefit. I mean, that's what gives the Ottoman Empire so much flexibility.
In the folk memory of Christian families in these lands, the Ottoman experience persists.
The Serbs have always cherished their narrative history. I learned at school that Turkey was an oppressor who conquered the Balkans and made many Orthodox Christians convert to Islam.
Nedeljko Zelenović is a theatre director in Republika Srpska, the part of Bosnia that Serb forces retained at the end of the war in 1995 and which is now run as an autonomous Serb-governed territory. Now in his 50s, he grew up in communist Yugoslavia, lived through the Bosnian War, and retains a powerful inherited sense of national grievance. Serbs to this day talk with bitterness about the Ottoman practice of conscripting Janissaries, young boys taken from Christian families to be trained as soldiers in Istanbul to staff the Sultan's household troops and bodyguards, even though the Janissary Corps was disbanded in 1826.
Young Serb boys were taken away from their homes and taken to Istanbul, where they converted and were raised according to Islamic tradition.
Did the Serbian nation, the Serbian people, suffer under Ottoman rule?
Of course. They had to give away one-tenth of their property and earnings, and they also had to give away their children to become Janissaries. Parents would disfigure their children by cutting off their fingers so they wouldn't be taken.
That folk memory, that reading of Ottoman history, helped fuel the passions that drove the Bosnian War in the 1990s.
One of the main reasons why these things happened in the last decade of the 20th century was because they followed a blueprint which was set in the 19th century. When you read the Serbian propaganda, many Bosnian Muslims who are ethnically Slavic have been labeled and named as Turks. And the message was, Turks, go back to Asia. And even though Bosnian Muslims are indigenous people here, the Serbs, they still force this propaganda that the Bosnian Muslims were actually a foreign element in Bosnia, but also a foreign element in Europe.
The Ottoman legacy made Bosnia in 1992 unique and uniquely vulnerable. For the multi-ethnic, multi-confessional nature of Ottoman society had survived here. Other Balkan provinces of the empire had become, for the most part, mono-ethnic nation-states. Serbia for the Serbs, Greece for the Greeks, Bulgaria for the Bulgarians. As the Balkan populations rose against the Ottomans to found their own nation-states, they set about destroying the Ottoman legacy. Buildings of Ottoman style or imperial purpose were demolished. Only one mosque is left standing in Belgrade. Mosques once dominated the city skyline.
Caravans, sarais, bazaars, and numerous mosques, some 80 mosques at a certain point.
So this was a Muslim city?
Absolutely, with some Christian inhabitants.
Slobodan Marković from the Faculty of Political Science at the University of Belgrade.
It basically lasts till 1688. That's the year when the Austrians took the town. Within 6 years, frontiers drastically changed. In 1683, Vienna almost fell. Ottomans reached a certain point even in Vienna. 6 years later, Austrians were already in Skopje.
In Macedonia, that far south.
That far south.
And what happened to the Muslim population during that massive Austrian advance of the late 17th century?
Well, they would retreat together with the army. No one would dare to stay. So essentially, identity was based on religion. Well into the 19th century in the Balkans, basically meant that if there was a Christian ruler, Muslims would not stay.
The process accelerated in the 19th century. As the empire collapsed, most Muslim populations in the emerging nation-states left or were expelled or killed. Millions of Balkan Muslims fled to Turkey, to Istanbul or Anatolia, where for some their ancestors had originated generations earlier. But not Bosnia. In 1878, Bosnia was occupied by forces of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The local governing elite, mostly Muslim, were retained and co-opted by the Austrians. By the dawn of the 20th century, the nation-state as an idea was coming of age almost everywhere else in the Balkans, but not in Bosnia.
Actually, you know, there was no national identity that came only after the French Revolution to the Balkans. It was a Western invention that was imported. And, of course, you know, it had a very dramatic effects. In 1990s, no one recognizes it anymore as a European feature, but actually nationalism is a byproduct of Europeanization of the Balkans.
The Balkan Wars of 1912 and 1913 pushed huge numbers of Muslims to Turkey, which within a few years would itself abandon Ottoman multi-ethnicity and adopt nation-statehood. A Turkey for the Turks.
Would you like to have a Turkish coffee or middle?
Mehmet Kemal Boze is Turkey's ambassador to Serbia.
After the Balkans Wars and also after the First World War, we got many people migrating to Turkey. And we were in 1933, 10 million, and 2.5 million of these 10 million came from this region. And this is a bridge. And now, with the new dynamics of Turkey, we are back to the areas which are in the vicinity of Turkey with some kinship connections and also geographically close relations. Today, 120,000 trucks of Turkey running the trade of Turkey to Europe is transiting Serbia.
For Turkey has a folk memory too, buried through most of the 20th century, but reawakening now. It is a folk memory of Balkan roots. Sinan Ulgen.
Most of the Ottoman intelligentsia, be it the military intelligentsia, be it the bureaucratic intelligentsia, were from the Balkans. And that is why the loss of the Balkans came as and was lived as a big tragedy for the Turks of the time, namely the late Ottoman era and the early Republican era, because many people trace back its roots to the Balkans. And that is also where most of the intellectual thinking and leadership of the Ottomans emerged.
Here in Višnjeva Street, just across the student park, is the tomb of...
In Belgrade, the Serbian capital, Gordana Andrić, the journalist who's been investigating Ottoman sites, took me on a tour of what little survives architecturally of the Ottoman centuries. The Turkish government is now restoring some of it.
So as we come up this hill, so we're surrounded by pretty unexceptional-looking modern buildings built after the Second World War. Until we come to this, it looks like a construction site at first glance, but in fact, behind the scaffolding, you can see an octagonal building in blonde sandstone with a shallow roof on it, about two stories high, about the size of a little house, really. What is this?
This is a tomb of Ottoman dervish. It's a religious order of Muslims.
So this is the tomb of a 17th century Muslim religious leader in the Ottoman Empire?
Yeah.
And the Turkish government has paid for this restoration to happen?
Yes, a part of a bigger scale of restorations that Turks are funding across the Balkans.
After a dormant century, there are other ways in which the past that Turkey shares with its Balkan neighbours is reawakening. This is a clip from one of the most popular TV drama series in the world. It has more than 100 million devoted viewers. It's now in its third series. It's called Magnificent Century, and it's set at the court of the 16th century Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, at the height of Ottoman imperial splendor.
İbrahim, bu gece burada kal, odanda.
Yılmaz Sahin is the program's scriptwriter.
Biz Rutanya'da doğmuş.
The series charts the story of a 17-year-old rural girl who's brought to the Ottoman court and becomes the Sultan's wife. Through the story of this couple, we tell the story of the whole century.
The great interesting thing is how popular the series is, not just in Turkey, but in the near abroad, in the lands that used to be part of the Ottoman Empire. How do you explain the appeal in those countries?
Yes, power game.
Partly, it's about the power games of the Ottoman court. In that era, the Ottomans were in the Middle East, in the Balkans, so we have characters from those places.
Their history as well, exactly.
It isn't screened in Western Europe, but in the lands with direct experience of or contact with the Ottoman Empire, it is wildly popular. In Bosnia, Serbia, Bulgaria, Greece, Albania, Croatia, Hungary, Austria. Keeping this folk memory of a Turkey rooted in a European identity is vital to the political aspirations of Turkey's Islamist government. Re-evoking the Balkan connection is a way of tying Turkey's future to that of Europe, with the Balkans as link or bridge. For all the AKP's desire to re-engage with Turkey's Arab neighbours, for all of its frustration and resentment with Europe, Europe remains key. For Turkey, abandoning the European dream altogether is not an option. Sinan Ulgen.
When we look at Turkish trade, Europe is still Turkey's first trading partner. 38% of Turkish exports go to Europe. But more importantly, Turkey is very well integrated with the financial economy. More than 80% of foreign direct investments in Turkey are of European origin. And these are very important to foster the type of growth rates that we have seen in the recent past.
We have set out to be your reliable business partner.
In 2009, CETA, the Serbian International Trade Association, was set up in Belgrade to represent Turkish business in Serbia. This is the soundtrack of one of its dramatically self-confident video promotions. Omer Simsek is CETA's chairman.
My family came to Serbia from Turkey in the 1650s while the region was still part of the Ottoman Empire. They left the Balkans in 1953 to go back to Istanbul during the years of communism in Yugoslavia.
What was your home language when you grew up?
Turkish. We spoke Turkish at home. Both my parents also spoke the languages of the former Yugoslav countries they lived in, but not to me.
But you feel at home here now. Your ancestors are from here. You've come back.
Yes, I feel very much at home here, just as many Serbs travelling to Turkey feel at home there too. We have similar traditions, food. We're not foreigners in each other's countries.
By some estimates, there are still 3,000 words of Turkish origin in use in Serbia and Bosnia today. The term Balkans even derives from a Turkish word meaning a chain of wooded mountains. But Turkish investment in the Balkans remains in its infancy. Turkish companies invested $400 million in Serbia in the year CETA was established. That had risen to $500 million last year. Even so, the symbolism remains of the Balkans as Turkey's anchorage in Europe.
It is very natural for a state having a big potential economic power to look for new markets and also having kinship, to use kinship as a bridge. This is very natural.
Mehmet Kemal Bozid, Turkey's ambassador in Belgrade.
If a Turkish textile investor comes here and makes its production here together with a Serbian counterpart, it goes to the other countries in the Serbian quota as Serbian production with some gains for the Turkish investors.
What of this summer's anti-government demonstrations and Prime Minister Erdogan's growing reputation for authoritarian rule done to Turkey's European dream? Sinan Ulgen.
In the short term, it has produced almost a mini crisis in Turkey-EU relations. The two sides had agreed, actually, before these events, to open a chapter of the negotiations after a hiatus of 36 months, 3 years. But as a result of the way that the government has reacted to those protest movements, there has been some concerns among EU member states. Finally, a new formula has been found, which essentially boils down to having officially opened the chapters, but nonetheless delaying the start of the talks that normally should come with the opening of a chapter. And it's the first time that in the whole history of the EU enlargement negotiations we come to experience such a formula. So this is where we stand today.
And what of Europe? Does it need Turkey? Will the borders of our common European home really extend one day that far east, into the biblical lands of Mesopotamia and the frontier with Iran? The Italian Foreign Minister, Emma Bonino, believes that much of what has happened this summer to fuel tension between Prime Minister Erdogan and the Gezi Park demonstrators can be traced back to Europe's decision in 2005 to keep Turkey at arm's length, neither fully in nor fully out of the community of European nations.
At that time, I was part of the Independent Commission on Turkey, and we published two reports saying that this position, in fact, began a sort of a vicious circle by which some part of Europe were, let's say, resistant, and had as a counter effect pushing Turkey to find other alternatives or other allies or other contacts.
And do you think there's a danger now that Turkey, under Prime Minister Erdogan, will turn its back on Europe and seek alliances in the Arab world, in the lands of the old Ottoman Empire, essentially?
No, I don't think so. And the region over there, just to think of Syria and etc., is full of problems, frankly speaking. So I hope we will find, as a mature democracy in Europe, the strength and also the vision to restart in bona fide this process, which is in the basic interest not only of the Turkish people, but also of Europe as such.
Think of the conflicts that have dominated our lifetimes. Lebanon, Bosnia, Kosovo, Israel-Palestine, Iraq, the struggle against dictatorship in North Africa, and now Syria. Each in its own way has its roots in the collapse of the Ottoman Empire a century ago. Similarly, the fight for the soul of Turkey itself remains unresolved, for two Turkeys there are, in constant tension with each other. But they coexist in a settled and entrenched secular republic and democratic nation-state, and that achievement, despite everything, endures. Turkey, the New Ottomans, was presented by me, Alan Little, and produced for the BBC World Service by Jane Beresford. Document.